This is the takeaway for Wednesday, June 21st, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Time sure flies. The summer solstice, do you believe it? And like that bleached bone armadillo skeleton in the sun, the healthcare reform or unreform that was once the signature policy initiative of the Trump administration, right, in those first 100 days, now seems like it's moving toward reality about as fast as roadkill. Actually, there are signs of some up-tempo railroading going on in the U.S. Senate, and we will talk about that with Todd Zwillick in just a moment. Meanwhile, the real roadkill and the car tires of America are simmering in a record Southwest 119 or more degree heat wave this week. So on the solstice, we're going to note a more than 2,000-year-old scientific milestone. Please stay tuned for that. We'll also talk about the Georgia victory that puts gold in Trump campaign coffers and was record Democratic cash down the drain. Later on, we'll hear about how police training may so complicate what officers see in moments of deadly force that videotapes of police shootings may never fully resolve things. Now, I can't say whether your health depends on it, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has pledged to have a vote on whatever health care bill the U.S. Senate is working on before July 4th. Some Republican senators who are supposed to be in the so-called GOP working group are getting a little impatient with their colleagues. And here's Republican Utah Senator Mike Lee in a Facebook video posted yesterday.
I've had a lot of people ask me specifically when the health care bill is going to be released to the public, why it isn't public. The short answer to the question is I haven't seen it yet either. Even though I've been a member of this working group, I haven't seen the bill. And it has become increasingly apparent in the last few days that it's not being written by us. It's apparently being written by a small handful of staffers for members of the Republican leadership in the Senate. So if you're frustrated by the lack of transparency in this process, I share your frustration. I share it wholeheartedly.
Has the government been taken over by a handful of policy wonk staffers? Is that what Senator Lee is saying? With more on Senate healthcare developments from Washington, here's Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
Is Mike Lee being Mr. Explainer guy or being Mr. I'm really angry guy?
Mike Lee is frustrated, and I think it's genuine, but Mike Lee and some of his co-frustrated Republican senators with this process, John, are participating in a little bit of misdirection. And I'll get to that after I give you this little bit of news from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who says he's going to have something to discuss later this week.
I expect to have a discussion draft on Thursday, and we will go to the bill, obviously, once we get a CBO score.
There's Mitch McConnell saying that they are forging ahead with a discussion draft that senators, at least Republican senators, will be able to look at on Thursday. Now, you asked about Mike Lee's frustration with an opaque and secretive process. He's not alone. Senators from across the Republican conference, including John McCain, many others, have been going on television saying they're frustrated with the process and also that they don't like it because it's hypocritical, because they are now doing the exact same thing that Democrats did when they passed Obamacare back in 2009 and 2010. Here's an example. Here's Rand Paul from Kentucky.
Once again, I mean, we were very polarized because the Democrats did, frankly, exactly the same thing. Well, exactly the same thing. I mean, I don't think the parties are any different.
I don't think the parties are ever any different, and this is the exact same thing. I called this a little bit of misdirection coming from Republicans, John, and here's why. A lot of people are covering this story as one of hypocrisy. Republicans are now being criticized by their own for doing the same thing that Democrats did those 7 years ago. Here's the reality. This process is nothing like what happened those 7 years ago when Obamacare passed. I know, because I was there for all 8 months that it took to pass Obamacare from start to finish. There were more than 40 legislative hearings and open public markup. Some of them took days. The markup in the Senate Finance Committee alone took more than 2 days. There were weeks of debate on the Senate floor. That's not what's happening here. There were parts of the Democratic process that used the same legislative tricks, reconciliation, that Republicans will use here to pass it with just 50 votes. That part is the same. But in terms of the amount of public transparency, public debate, amendments from senators and markups, I call this misdirection, because this process that we're experiencing now is nothing like it happened when Obamacare passed.
Although that was then and this is now, and it will remain for history to judge which party behaved worse on healthcare reform in the early part of the 21st century. But I want to go back to what Mitch McConnell said there in that little news bite that you gave to us, that, okay, he'll have a discussion draft out. And unlike what the House did, if I'm not mistaken, he's going to put the discussion draft out of the Senate up for a CBO, a Congressional Budget Office score on how much it costs, which is not what the House members were willing to do. Am I wrong on that?
Mitch McConnell doesn't have a choice in this case. Because of the rules under this reconciliation procedure, there has to be a CBO score so that the parliamentarian in the Senate can decide if this bill meets the arcane rules that Mitch McConnell is using here. It's perfectly legit, but he doesn't have a choice but to put that CBO score out. And that's going to be politically difficult for him when it happens and he knows it, because that score, we don't know what it's going to say, what it's going to cost, but it will say that several, many million Americans will not have insurance after 10 years who have it now. We know it's going to say that because Republicans are cutting billions from healthcare, including Medicaid. We don't know how many people will lose insurance, but that's going to be difficult politics. And that gives you an idea of why Mitch McConnell, as of right now, John, as of this discussion, doesn't have the votes that he needs, the 50 votes. Why? There are Republicans with priorities all over this thing who are uncomfortable already with the outlines that they think they're seeing from this Senate bill. The rollback of Medicaid, the Obamacare Medicaid expansion, it appears that the Senate may roll back that expansion more slowly than the House did, but may cut it even deeper than the House wanted to. And there are Republican senators in states with governors all over the place, like Ohio, West Virginia, who are extremely nervous about the rollback in Medicaid because their states rely on it. There's politics around tax credits, how much to roll them back, how much they'll be worth, how many people might lose insurance. There's the long-term growth rate of Medicaid. Once you cut it, how will Medicaid survive over those many years? And one last thing, here's Martin Heinrich. He's from New Mexico. He's a Democrat, but he expresses a similar thing that a lot of Republicans are worried about in rural states when it comes to cutting Medicaid.
If you don't have Medicaid well-funded to be able to deal with the opioid epidemic, you cannot deal with the opioid epidemic.
Well, the opioid epidemic is one big issue, and there are others that people are very much focused on as this secretive Senate bill moves towards a discussion draft. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Is it something about police training that makes the deadly force encounter like the one between Geronimo Yanez and Philando Castile so plausible to some? A jury is supposed to reflect community standards in its verdicts. And perhaps one of those standards is an increasingly military notion of what police are supposed to do. Dan Grossman, a retired Army Ranger, he's also a West Point instructor and author, and he's a preeminent figure behind the warrior policing approach. He travels the country, lecturing to tens of thousands of police, military, and first responders.
A warrior fights violence. And what do they fight it with? Violence. Violence is your tool. Violence is your enemy. Violence is the realm you live in, and you must master it, or it will destroy you.
When writer Steve Featherstone set out to write an article for the New Republic about Grossman, he took along his father, a retired policeman from Syracuse, New York. It was an unforgettable experience for a father and son, and two rare and different windows for all of us on how to see policing.
I was really curious to see how my dad would receive Grossman's message and what he would think about it, because I think the eras of policing that my dad comes from, he became a cop in the early 60s and retired in the late 90s. So he saw like an era of policing that really is gone today. And I really was curious to see what my dad thought of that message.
Robert, what did you think?
I thought he provided a lot of good information, technical information, and also I think what he was trying to do was to emphasize to these people at the seminar that you have to be aware at all times on the job. You have to be well-trained. You have to be fair but firm when you're dealing with the public or with anybody, and in particular with certain suspects or situations. And you don't have the ability to second-guess or Monday morning quarterback a situation. You've got to take the appropriate action, not always to kill somebody. But
Robert, during your time as a police officer, did you ever encounter civilians on a call you believed that you were in war, that you believed you were on the front lines?
Oh, yeah, yes. I was working with my partner, Dean Bender, and we were down on a city street here in Syracuse, and it was a domestic problem. And we noticed a guy downstairs, and he was quite intoxicated, you know. So we had to go upstairs to find out what was going on. So we went up this narrow stairway, and as the door opened, we heard this click, click. When the door opened, there's a guy standing there with a 12-gauge shotgun, and he's got it about a foot and a half away from Dean's head. But fortunately, Dean just reached in and pushed up the barrel of the shotgun and started talking to the guy. And the guy realized it wasn't the guy he was mad at. It was the police.
Can I interrupt a second, John?
Sure.
That situation, it's really hard to imagine occurring today. And the guy with the shotgun on the other side of that door not being dead. And I'm not saying that cops today just kill everybody with a gun or just shoot down people needlessly. It's just that it seemed to me in all the anecdotes that my father was telling me, you know, before the seminar as we're driving down, that there was this preference to deal with people on a sort of one-to-one basis and not to overreact to what are clearly dangerous situations where, you know, increase the probability of somebody ending up dead. And I think what my opinion is that Grossman, what he teaches, does increase that likelihood. The way cops are trained today over the past couple of decades has been, you know, it's heavily reliant on the fatal and the deadly encounter, sort of, you know, training for the worst case scenario. And that makes sense. I mean, this is we live in a violent culture. You know, there's a gun for every man, woman, and child in this country. At the same time, you know, a case like we saw, like the Sandra Bland case, right? No one died in that. No one was shot. But there's an example of where that kind of comply at all costs warrior mentality contributed to a tragic outcome.
Well, I believe Grossman's correct, and he's doing a great service for the police department and the community. He's trying to train and teach people that if you do have to use deadly physical force, then you have to do it, and you can't feel guilty about it later because that's your job. And you did the right thing based on what you observed or what you saw and what results needed to be taken.
Robert, do you think that you have to use a different part of your training if you're policing in a white community than if you're policing in a black community, that it takes a different kind of outlook to be effective?
Not at all. I mean, we don't have a special training for officers in the black community or the white community. As a matter of fact, as a first few years on a force, you might be working today in the black community, tomorrow in the white community, and et cetera, et cetera. This is all a figment of people's imagination that policemen treat black people different than they do white people or whatever. There's only one kind of people we deal with, and that's the person we're dealing with right now. And he can be a good guy, he can be a jerk or whatever.
Well, Steve, I don't want to put you on the spot with your dad.
Sure.
But in our day and age, is what he's talking about incomplete, do you think?
Yeah, no, I think it is, only because my dad's very much an individualist, and I tend to look at things in terms of more contextual. For instance, I would say, you know, racism, racial bias, implicit bias is sort of baked into the system. I mean, it's baked into our criminal justice system. So on an individual basis, no doubt the vast majority of cops, you could even say all cops, let's say every single one of them are, as individuals, not racist. But if you're working in a system that has implicit bias baked into it, you are going to be in some part enforcing a racially biased system. It's impossible not to. I agree. I think my dad is definitely someone who is very fair-minded, but I think he's probably the thing that struck me most, I think, from when we got home. And I asked him, so, you know, what did you think? Do you think this kind of training would be good for all cops? And what was your response, Dad? Do you remember?
I was impressed with the training, and I thought that this training probably would be great for the SWAT teams. Possibly your investigators, because they have to respond to some critical situations. Might not be necessary for the beat cop, the rookie beat cop. Might be a great tool for the more experienced officer that could understand after some on-job training, what Mr. Grossman was coming across with. It's not the most important part of your training, but it's certainly a life-saving aspect if you're going to survive in today's culture, because there's so many knotheads out there that think nothing of killing people, not just policemen. I mean, they just go out and kill people on the street to see how it feels. It's really ridiculous.
That's Robert Featherstone, a retired Syracuse police officer, along with his son, Steve Featherstone, a writer. And now a very famous piece of video from a very tragic event on a Minnesota street. And this is the reaction of a law professor who's very disturbed every time she sees it or hears it, as you will be in a moment.
In watching that video, I honestly don't know what is more overwhelming, the tremendous outrage that I feel or the sadness that I feel from watching that video.
Law professor Elise Boddy of Rutgers University is putting herself in the mind of the jury in Minnesota that last week cleared Officer Geronimo Yanez on all charges, including involuntary manslaughter in the shooting death of Philando Castile. Here is a portion of the full video released yesterday, what the jury saw and heard as police pulled over a car for a faulty brake light.
Sir, I have to tell you, I do have a firearm on me.
Don't reach for it, then. Don't pull it out. Don't pull it out.
Castile tries to tell the officer that he is legally carrying a firearm while driving back from grocery shopping with his girlfriend and her 4-year-old daughter in the car. The officer's bullets kill Castile while his grieving girlfriend acknowledges, both with shock and resignation, that she has become a victim of something well known to African Americans. Elise Boddy, professor at Rutgers Law School, says there is a limit to how many times society will permit this comparison between a shocking police shooting video and a shocking jury verdict that decides there was no crime at all.
I think the tragedy is that the video is not all that different from what we've seen time and time again. I think many of us thought that with the benefit of a video, with the benefit of being able to witness what was happening to so many Black people across the country, that things would change. And what we know from the verdict in the Castile case, Officer Yanez, was that things haven't changed. So it's hard to process that and know what to say about it.
Legally speaking, why would the situation for the videos being played in public be so different in court versus on, say, for instance, an open forum like this program or CNN?
The problem is that we have a body of doctrine in the law that makes it extremely difficult to prosecute police officers for this kind of action. The law tends to focus on the officer's perspective and his or her own subjective fears and whether it was reasonable for him in that moment to fear for his life. And that's what the law says. But the problem is, and I think what people are responding to when they watch the video, is that the law maps onto this pervasive fear of Black people. And so if everyone is afraid of Black people and we have laws that say that that fear is justified, then this is the kind of result that we get.
So what you're saying in part is that in a criminal case, the burden of reasonable doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt, is such a high bar for the defendant, in this case, police officers, that jurors have to put aside any sense of suspicion about African-Americans that they've ever held in virtually any context in their lives. And that's almost ludicrous given the state of racial tension in the United States right now.
Well, it's that the law focuses on the subjective beliefs and perspectives of the police officer in that moment. The burden of proof is so high on the prosecution in these kinds of cases that it's just extremely difficult to get a verdict against a police officer. But if I could, John, I think we have a very significant deep racial sickness in this country. And we have to address that through law. We have to address that through public conversation. We have to change the policies and practices that trap poor Black people in these kinds of systems of injustice. And so we have to change our way of thinking about the opportunities that Black people have in this country. We really need sort of a system renovation, I think.
Elise Boddy is a professor of law at Rutgers Law School. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Young Julian Baker has always wanted to use music and songwriting to channel her Hank Williams-style deep sadness into a tempest of 21st century music and song. She was only 19 when she put out her debut album. The title says nothing about broken hearts. It's the pain of her sprained ankle she wants to share in 2015. She was a college student from Memphis. Something about her authenticity and intensity got her picked up by a label, and she found some critical success. Julian is 21, now working on a new album for Matador Records, and she is smack in the middle of the indie fandom that follows the superstars The Decembrists around. She's touring with them. And while touring, she was happy to play some songs for us and talk about her young queer identity and a supportive family who's had some doubts about her capacity to break through. Those doubts are gone, though. Left are the themes of love, loss, addiction, and religion. Her sad song, she says proudly, and you can tell that somewhere up there, the spirit of Hank Williams would approve.
I do put my pain out there, but I do so with the caveat that it is not supposed to be a stagnant thing. It's not a worship of pain. Mm-hmm. There's like a process in there, and I think that's a very important distinction to make, because were I to merely perform in like an exhibitionist way and just put my suffering out there to gratify a need to have it validated by an audience, it would be unhealthy for the audience. It would be unhealthy for me. It would force me to just wallow and stay there. And so you have to express those parts of yourself only as a provision that it's a temporary or transient place.
I could quit, but I can't stand the shade. Choking in snow, singing your praise. I think there's a God and he hears either way. And I rejoice.
You cry out to God. God would hear it either way,
right,
in one of your lyrics.
True.
Is she answering you?
I like that you chose to gender God and with a female pronoun. I like that. Does God answer me? I think yes. I don't believe in speaking in absolutes, but yes.
Eons ago, when I was in television, I wanted to do a documentary piece for one of the ABC shows about the emerging voices in women voices in music. And I talked to a whole bunch of people, Courtney Love and all these people, and they would not go down there. I said, look, I want to just do this thing. No, it's going to be about like us and women, and it's going to be that old thing of we're women, we're lesbians, or we're this, or we're that. I don't want to do that. We are just artists, period, the end. And cool. They would not go.
Wow.
Do you think it's a different time now?
Fortunately, I think there's more representation for marginalized social groups in society, women in music, queer people in music, people of color in music. But I think a more important change that is happening, not just with society recognizing that, it's because people are no longer saying, I'm just an artist, and I choose to divorce my art from my identity. There's no longer that authorial vacuum delusion that you can just have the art be separate of its social context. And that's really important, because in order to make any kind of visibility happen for queer artists, for female artists, people of color, like, you have to be vocal about those things. And so I now don't mind, and I know my colleagues in music who are queer or females or, you know, non-male, invite that discourse, because that is creating a more rapid change towards people being accepting of the queer community or people destigmatizing women in music.
Wake up with the same pain every night, digging a hatchet into my left side, clearing my chest, something to burn. Ash for a decorative urn. You keep in your mantle piece like a trophy for everything.
Is sadness happy? You do a cover of Hank Williams.
Oh, wow. Yes, I love Hank Williams. Is sadness happy? That is, I mean, if you want to like lean into that oxymoron phrasing, I think sadness can be useful. I think sadness isn't permanent. I think happiness and joy are different. Happiness is a temperament. Joy is a personality trait and a tool and something that you can cultivate. And I think joy can exist at the same time as temporary sadness. And that is what I think about that.
Do you think you're successful?
I think I am very successful.
Because you can pay the bills or because you get opportunities to do wonderful things?
Because
or?
I get to do the thing that I love.
Mm-hmm.
I get to pay my bills. I get to share opportunities with my friends. I get to play music. I get to establish a dialogue between myself and an audience that is about something more than my problems. I get to reassign significance to the worst things in my life and make them opportunities for growth and invitations for conversation that are actually positive. I think that's what success is.
Julian Baker, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Julian Baker's debut album is called Sprained Ankle. She's currently working on her second. On a hot day when the sun feels closer than it should, it's only natural that one would want to look for shadows. It's the first day of summer, and some of the records being broken already suggest we might all be doing some serious shadow hunting in 2017. But more than 2,000 years ago, the hunt for shadows on the solstice, or more correctly, the hunt for no shadows on the solstice, produced an unbelievable scientific discovery. It proved that the Earth was not flat, for one thing, long before Christopher Columbus set sail in 1492. Today, the summer solstice, every year marks the day over 2,000 years ago that Eratosthenes of Cyrene made a stunning calculation. Dr. Stuart Clark, who writes the Across the Universe column for The Guardian, and he's the author of The Unknown Universe, says it's the story of a scientist looking carefully at tiny details on the Earth's surface and using mathematics to come to some pretty huge conclusions.
Yeah, this is an absolutely fascinating story. So he was the chief librarian at the Great Library of Alexandria in about the 3rd century BC. And as the story goes, he was reading one of the library's many, many manuscripts. And what he saw there was an account from Cyrene, which is now Aswan in Egypt. And in that account, it said that on the summer solstice in that city, the shadows completely disappeared. And in fact, some versions of the story say that the shafts of sunlight fell directly down a well in Aswan, where most of the year the sun didn't reach the bottom. But on this particular day, the sun beams reached straight down the well and hit the water.
Which is kind of a curious fact for a tour guide. Even back then, but for Eratosthenes, it was what?
So it was a real moment of wondering, because he wondered if the same would happen in his city of Alexandria. And so on the next solstice, he went out and he started looking at the shadows. And as noon approached, the shadows shortened and shortened and shortened, but never did they disappear like they did in Cyrene. And so what he realized was that the Earth's surface must be curved, because if it's exactly the same time in Cyrene, the shadows disappeared, but in Alexandria, the shadows were still visible, it meant that the pillars of the temples were obviously inclined to one another. And that meant that you must be on the curved surface of the Earth. And by measuring the length of the shadows in Alexandria and knowing the distance between the two cities, he could work out the circumference of the Earth. And he got really close, within about 10% of our modern measured value.
Did Eratosthenes' discovery remain hidden, remain obscure, or was it gradually absorbed into the consciousness of the ancient world, in that we began to think of the Earth and the Sun as moving bodies in space a little bit more than these kind of pre-Copernican, you know, landscapes, I guess, sketched out by God?
So his calculation was obviously recorded and disseminated. So it did pass into the record of what was known about the Earth and passed on in that way. It says nothing, however, about which is moving. Are we going around the Sun or is the Sun going around us? So it was open to interpretation in that respect. And again, it passes from Alexandria. It passes into the Arab world, where they keep a lot of these records going, then comes back to Europe in the Middle Ages through Spain and becomes part of the driving force of the Renaissance in Italy. And then we start to have the Copernican Revolution as we really start to look at what is moving. Is it the Earth or the Sun?
It's fascinating that Eratosthenes doesn't care, doesn't really need to know which
is interesting.
Moving.
Yeah, it doesn't really need to know, because all movement is relative. It's very difficult sometimes to say whether you're moving or the thing next to you is moving. And of course, that then gets picked up in the early 20th century by Albert Einstein, who develops his theory of relativity on exactly this basis.
And do you think that Einstein and Eratosthenes were on the same playground, in the sense that you observe very carefully this world and these subtleties suddenly reveal through mathematics these unbelievable theories? In his case, the circumference of the Earth. In Einstein's case, the theory of relativity.
Yes, that's a really perceptive comment, because that's exactly what is happening here. Both of them, Eratosthenes just sees the length of shadows at noon on a particular day. Einstein sees a tiny little anomaly in the way that Mercury is moving. And both of them determine to understand why these little effects take place. And in so doing, they open up a much wider world. In the case of Einstein, this little strange movement in Mercury's orbit that couldn't be explained by Isaac Newton's gravity, once Einstein understands exactly how to explain that, it leads to everything we think about as modern astrophysics and cosmology today. Black holes, the birth of the universe in the Big Bang. Wow. And all of that just from this tiny, tiny little movement of Mercury that we couldn't explain before.
Well, happy solstice.
Happy solstice to you.
And may the summer not be too fierce in this era of climate change. And maybe we'll keep the world that Eratosthenes observed a little more intact for a few millennia longer.
That is what I wish for you as well.
Dr. Stuart Clark writes Across the Universe for The Guardian. He's the author of The Unknown Universe and Is There Life on Mars? 21st century solstice wishes there between me and Dr. Stuart. On the longest day of the year, let's think about it. What does the summer solstice mean to you?
Hi, this is Gail Sieberts from Anchorage, Alaska, and I love midsummer because it is our longest day, 19 hours and 20 minutes. And from here, it's all downhill until December. So I cherish the daylight at this time of year.
This is Chris Sumption. I'm calling from Seattle, Washington. And this year, I'm spending the summer solstice at the vigil for Charlena Lyles, the Seattle woman gunned down by police after she called to report a burglary. We need more sunlight on police violence, more accountability for police officers, and justice for victims.
Love your stories. Love your comments. Everyone's invited to speak to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Hollywood, Florida had this. I only celebrate if I spend the day in Norway. There we do bonfires along the fjords. Everyone celebrates the longest day of the year. It's a great tradition that we do not see so much here in the U.S. Well, I'm going to start a bonfire in my office. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.